You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. We are going to take a big journey into time and across the globe. Eventually, we'll get right back to the center of your own body. Our tour guides are Dr. David Montgomery from the University of Washington and biologist Anne Beakley. David and Anne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you.
I know the two of you just released a new book, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. That's a personal journey with a big message for us all. But at the risk of being rude, I'd like to start with you, David. A recent guest, Benoit Lambert, and several listeners asked for this interview based on your previous book, Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. That's coming back, and not only because we may farm ourselves right out of the soil in this century, but also because of that promise we could reverse the process, putting big amounts of carbon back into the soil, and maybe avert catastrophic climate change. Okay, well now, to be blunt, we're all busy people. Why should we care about what happens to dirt? Can you give us the nutshell on that one?
Well, yeah, you know, if you look around the world today at the areas that we sort of find to be perennially troublesome hotspots, places like Syria and Libya, for example, they're places that long ago those societies essentially degraded and destroyed their soils, and they've been impoverished ever since. So if we can look at healthy, fertile soil quite literally as the foundation, both ecological and economic, for healthy, thriving civilizations. And that's something that all of us really have a stake in. And if you then take it sort of further to our own food and nutrition and bodies, as we do in the new book, there's connections to our personal health as well. Yet we tend to take soil for granted. And this has gotten societies into trouble in the past. But as you alluded to, there's certain causes for optimism these days in terms of thinking about what a different way of thinking about our soil can do for some of the big problems we face.
Well, it's a bit different now because we're globalized. I mean, if China right now is buying up farmland in Africa, if that land gets overused and then can't produce, there are global repercussions. Don't you think it's a bit of a game changer when we can't just move on to a new continent and try farming there?
No, exactly. That is the big concern for this sort of most recent round of sort of land use abuse and soil degradation that we're going through. Societies in the past have been able to sort of, you know, move laterally to different places, to new and fresh soils. And the United States is an example of a country that has done this over the last several hundred years. But we're really out of land that we might potentially farm over the long run that we're not already farming. So we don't really have anywhere else to go if we spoil the health of the land this time around. We really have to get it right this time.
Yeah, I don't think the soils on Mars are going to cut it.
No, they're you know, you look at the chemistry, it's really sort of battery acid. It's not really healthy, fertile soil, and they're missing the microbes for all that we know, and the atmosphere is not that conducive. No, we're not. If we ever terraform Mars, it's going to be a long time from now. It's not getting us through this century.
I was surprised to learn from you that soil erosion was already a problem in America before there was the United States. The fathers of the country wrote about it. What was happening in colonial America?
Yeah, well, you know, the crop that got colonial America off the ground economically and its relationship with Europe, so that goods would keep going back and forth and feed the sort of the fuels of the economic fire, was tobacco. And tobacco was a crop, the way it was cultivated colonially, and in some places still today, was very erosive and hard on the soil. So you could essentially get 3 to 5 years of a very productive, profitable crop out of a piece of land that you'd cleared before you had to move on to fresh land to clear again and start the process all over again. And that led in part to the rise of plantation agriculture because they needed large acreages to be able to keep moving around where one farmed over time. And the degradation of the soil over time in colonial North America became important in the sense that it started to decrease crop yields, it started to impact the economy. And people at the very top of American society, the highest echelons, people like Washington and Jefferson and Franklin, noticed the problem and worked on trying to bring crop rotations in and fill in gullies and to try to work to rebuild soil fertility. But the vast majority of planters in the colonies did not sort of follow those kind of recommendations. And it gradually, as Washington predicted, drove the American people inland, westward, to continue the search for new and fertile land on the other side of the mountains.
But even when they got there, I've seen a photo of a church in Iowa that's about 8 feet above the surrounding lands. Can we lose that amount of soil that fast?
Oh, yeah. You know, year to year, it doesn't seem to happen all that fast. But if you keep up something that goes even just like a few millimeters a year, if you keep that up for centuries, it can really add up to burning through the topsoil. And that example of the churchyard, it's perched on a person-high pedestal of soil as the surrounding farmlands eroded away, is a pretty dramatic example. But it's a good illustration of essentially what can happen over time if we have practices that lead to eroding soils faster than we're rebuilding them or than in fact nature can make them.
But what are we going to do here, David? I mean, we can't give up farming. That's how we feed the billions of people on the earth.
Oh, yeah. No, what we need to do is figure out ways of farming that can actually restore and rebuild and then maintain soil fertility and the physical body of the soil itself, even while we use it to intensively grow food. And I've spent the last 6 months actually touring around farms around the world looking at farmers whose practices can actually do that and turn this problem around. It's a set of processes that I sort of first became aware of actually by watching my wife garden and transform our yard in North Seattle from a barren lot into a lush garden. And the idea that you could, through the way you managed organic matter on the landscape, reignite the microbial fires, the microbial life that fuel the turnover of nutrients that drive soil fertility, it was a real eye-opener to me. And then those same kind of principles, it turns out, are things that are being practiced in conservation agriculture to actually rebuild fertility to soils, improve crop yields, sequester carbon in agricultural soils, things that you can view as long-term investments in our ability to keep our agricultural enterprise actually fruitful and productive over the long run.
In the big agribusiness, it seems like we're almost doing hydroponics. I mean, we just use the soil as something to hold the plants upright while we feed them fossil fuels, but we're going to run out of fossil fuels eventually, or maybe they'll be banned as climate disruption unfolds. If we let our soil become lifeless places, what happens then?
Well, then you can, if we really play it to conclusion, we're back to those examples of Libya and Syria, because that's sort of the end game. We don't want to get there. And you're right about the sort of 20th century philosophy of looking at soil as just something to hold the plants up while we add the nutrients. That's going to have to change this century for a host of reasons, not the least of which is as the price of fossil fuels goes up, whether from scarcity or from design as we try and wean ourselves off of them, it would behoove us to try and figure out less energy-intensive ways to farm and re-enlisting the microbial allies that plants have in soils and doing that on our farms is a way to try and push that forward. And it turns out that's sort of would require a change in thinking of agricultural practices from one of treating the soil as a medium to hold those chemicals that we would add to fertilize the ground to instead trying to recultivate the microbial life with organic matter that would help accelerate the processes of both nutrient extraction from rocks and minerals, but also the turnover and the recycling of the nutrients that are in that organic matter. And that requires a different set of practices, a different way of thinking about the soil and prioritizing soil health and those practices that can rebuild the health and integrity of the biological component of soils, and particularly microbial life and then the larger soil life that feeds on them and essentially functions like tiny livestock in our soils. It's fairly easy to picture about how, you know, sort of the livestock we know, cattle and bison and sheep and so forth, how their manure helps to close the cycle of returning nutrients back to the land. Microbial life below ground does very similar things, but it's out of sight, out of mind, and literally invisible. But it can be just as important in terms of maintaining fertility. But to cultivate the beneficial life in the soil, you have to change what we call conventional agriculture to practices that actually foster and support that life.
How did we get this far into the interview without saying the word plow?
Yeah, if you look at the one of the big forces that has driven the degradation of soils around the world, the plow is, you know, comes immediately to mind, and that was a major thrust of the book Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, where as a geologist I started to look into what sort of the factors that helped drive the decline of ancient societies, and I ended up writing essentially a history of farming, and the plow played a big role in causing the erosion of soils around the world where in those places where it was used. And it really did it two ways. One, from just direct movement of soil. When you plow across a hillside, you're moving dirt. And if you keep going at the same direction and bias over the long run and keep doing it, you're moving stuff downhill. You're accelerating the removal of soil off of the hilltops and parking it in the valley bottoms. And that can reduce the total area that you could have to farm. But what the plow also does is what it's designed to do. It inverts the soil. It leaves the soil bare and vulnerable to erosion by wind or rain for some portion of the year. And that can allow soil erosion to race ahead of soil production such that you're actually losing soil. And if that plays out over long enough, centuries as it turns out, you can essentially strip the soil right off the landscape. And it can take nature a long time to put it back because nature forms soils fairly slowly. But the lesson that Ann taught me in our yard was essentially that people, through the application of labor and energy and organic matter and enlisting microbial helpers, trillions of microbial assistants, we can actually rebuild soils much faster than nature tends to do on her own.
Well, I am a backyard gardener, so I'm pretty excited to be talking to Ann about that in just a minute. I want to cover just a couple more things from your previous work. I've had a series of guests talking about how to put carbon back into the soil and using biochar as a longer-term solution for climate change. Is this serious stuff? Can it work?
The short answer is yes. Could it actually sort of solve the climate problem? Well, that's sort of a bigger question that I'm not going to give you a solid answer on because I've seen very widely disparate estimates of how much carbon we could park back in the soil. But the key answer from my perspective is the farming practices that actually return carbon back to the land through cover cropping and encouraging, again, this microbial life to increase the standing stock of organic matter in soils. You know, if we could do that over agricultural land globally, it would take a huge bite out of the carbon in the atmosphere that we've added over the last century and a half. Biochar is a really interesting and very effective technology for parking carbon. It takes a long time for it to break down. You know, it obviously doesn't store it forever, but it can store it in forms that take a long time to break down, and it doesn't directly influence the fertility of the soil in the sense that the plants aren't sucking up the charcoal, but it I like to view it as you're building habitat for microbes that can then assist in the cycling of nutrients, and it can boost fertility in that regard. And it's also really good at holding moisture, holding water, something that it could be very useful in terms of a changing climate. And I look at the whole issue about whether we should be doing practices in agriculture, both the cover cropping angle and the biochar angle, that could increase the carbon content of our soils is something that it's one of the few investments we could make that could simultaneously help feed the world of tomorrow, rebuild soil fertility, but also help draw down atmospheric carbon dioxide. And many of the practices that actually help build soil carbon also require less in the way of fossil fuel inputs. So you're not only sequestering carbon, you're turning down emissions if we've made many of these kinds of changes in agricultural practices.
But I do know the French government brought carbon farming, they call it agroecology, to the Paris COP21 meeting. Have you heard any plans by any government in the world to start restoring soils in a serious way?
No, that Minister LaFalle's proposal to do that was the first time I'd heard the ideas being taken seriously at that level, and I think it's absolutely fabulous because we really do need to aggressively move towards doing that. And the farms that I've looked at in the last 6 months who have been increasing the carbon content of their soils fall right into that range that he was talking about. I'm saying, you know, 0.4% a year, or 0.5% of soil organic matter per year as feasible to reintroduce back into soil. So you look at the net acreage of farmland around the world, if we could do that everywhere and do it aggressively, it could make a huge difference. And it's one of the few technologies that's available that could actually improve the bottom line on farms by reducing our agrochemical inputs. It really is an idea whose time has come. I'm working on a new book now that sort of explores that through this farms around the world, and we should be promoting those ideas in a very, very serious way, and not just for the climate issue, but also to help solve the problem of how we're going to feed ourselves in the future. And it would also help with the biodiversity problem, because to a large degree, if we look at the area of the continents that are covered by agriculture, the kind of life that's going to be surviving along with us over for the next several hundred years, what we do on our farms is going to make a big difference to the species that are going to be able to stick around over the long run. For all those reasons, we ought to be encouraging those kind of activities.
This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking mostly about David Montgomery's earlier book, Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. But when we get to soil restoration, Montgomery has a research partner who has experimented in their own back garden, biologist Ann Bilkay. And let's get you in here. What was the challenge in your Seattle backyard, and what did you do about it?
Yeah, what happened was I had long wanted a garden. And when we finally were able to buy a house in Seattle, one of the reasons that we bought it is that it had this big side yard. And growing in that side yard was sort of this thicket of dandelions and maybe almost century-old grass. And so I saw this as one big blank slate. So what we did when we started our project was we peeled all of that right off of the lot. And then when we looked at our soil, we went, oh, my God, what are we going to do? This stuff is kind of sandy, khaki, light-colored. It's filled with a lot of rocks because of Seattle's glacial history, and there was just hardly any organic matter at all. And we also got stuck, sort of because of construction delays and so forth, with putting the plants in the ground at about the worst time of the year possible, late July. And once the plants were in the ground, I had done enough gardening to know that we needed to get something on top of this soil, both to start feeding the soil, and which thereby feeding the plants, but also to help us keep water in the ground during that first summer. So that's kind of where it all started.
It may seem like a small point, but if I dump a ton of manure on my back garden, my neighbors will not thank me. How did you get around that?
Well, that's interesting, because before we had our house, I brought manure home to the place that we were renting, and it wasn't our neighbor that objected so much. Oddly enough, it was my husband who said, "What is that smell and what have you done?" And I tried to calm him down and I told him, this smell will go away, but just wait till you see what it does to the plants. And in the case of the garden where we're now living, I didn't get any animal manures. By that time, we had sort of blown our budget on various other things for the garden, and the organic matter that we got came very locally. It came from me collecting neighbors' leaves. In particular, oak leaves make a really nice ingredient for a mulch. And every time I heard the sound of an arborist wood chipper in the neighborhood, I would track them down and pressure them to drop the wood chips off in our driveway. And then the other great source of organic matter, it's a source of nitrogen, is coffee grounds and espresso grounds. And there's, you know, heaps and heaps of that stuff laying around town. So those were sort of my three main ingredients. And then later on, we moved onto a worm bin and began doing a little bit of vermicomposting.
So, and now we get to a big plot twist. You are researching how to restore microbial life to the soils, but then something changed in your life that helped result in this new book with David. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So we'd been going along thrilled and enthralled with what the microbial world had done to transform our soil and our garden, and that had transformed our lives. There's no doubt about that. But then in about 2011, I got the kind of phone call from one's doctor that you never want to get. And I learned that I had a malignant cancer. Not only that, but that this cancer was caused by a microbe, by a virus. And so this sort of whiplashed my head, you know, right back the other way. And I wondered, oh, my God, what really is this microbial world? This has got this huge duality about it. You know, on the one hand, hugely beneficial, not only my experience, but we know through human history that microbes have interacted with us a lot through infectious diseases. So all this is sort of percolating around in our lives and in our minds. And it was around that time that we began to also dig into some of the microbiome research. And so the microbiome, it's funny, it's sort of this old field, but it's also sort of this new field. And it's we've known for a long, long time that microbes live on us. And certainly the plant scientists know that microbes live in the soil and on plants. But the new angle on all of this is that we're now able to figure out what some of these microbials are, like who are their members, what are the genomes of these microbes, and what do their genes allow them to do? And it turns out that in many respects, we are more microbial than we are ourselves. And so as we're, you know, parsing through this research, and I'm recovering from a horrendous surgery from cancer, it just sort of formed a backdrop for where does our health really come from? You know, is it from doctor's offices and drugs? But, you know, what about this whole new field of research that's turning up a lot of evidence that microbes are, in some ways underpinning the health of ourselves? That was sort of the big plot twist in the book, and how we then began to really dig into the human biology end of things.
We've talked with David about how our methods of agriculture have killed off a lot of the soil life. Did you find that our diets and our lifestyles are killing off beneficial microbes in our own bodies?
Yeah, well, that's sort of the leading hypothesis amongst microbiome researchers. And they think there's, at this point, two main factors for that, which are certainly since around World War II, our intake of antibiotics has increased hugely. And that is sort of the equivalent, you know, of a pesticide or an herbicide, but right inside of our bodies. And, you know, in some cases, there are some really bad actors that gain a foothold, and you do want to have ways to exterminate them. But the whole problem with antibiotics is that some are very broad spectrum, and so you're taking out all of our allies along with, you know, the one or two bad actors. So antibiotics have certainly had some effect on our microbiome. The other thing, which is not quite so straightforward as to how it might impact our microbiome, is our diet. And that's where there's some really pretty interesting parallels between what's going on with agricultural soils and the microbial life, and what's going on with what David and I sort of came to see is this parallel world of soil that is deep within our guts. In fact, right down at the bottom of our gut in our colons, you might liken that part of our anatomy and biology to a garden or to a farm, because turns out that, you know, that's where the lion's share of the trillions of microbial cells that are on and in our bodies actually dwell. It's sort of the creme de la creme, if you will, of the most biodiverse part of our bodies is in our colons.
And people don't like to talk about this. Have you encountered resistance?
No, we don't. We call it, you know, the least loved part of the body. We've been doing some talks on the book in the last several weeks, and part of that, the talk includes, we've got a PowerPoint that goes with it, and we've got some great figures of the colon. And, you know, this is pretty much what we have to say to people is, you know, look, we've all got to start thinking very differently and actually talking very differently about our colons, because the fact is, they are not some kind of onboard garbage can at all. They are this alchemical cauldron in which medicinal compounds are being produced that are not only just absolutely critical to the health of our colons, but it's looking like some of those compounds actually diffuse into our bloodstream and are distributed throughout the rest of our body. So what we really have is not an onboard garbage can. In many ways, it's like this onboard pharmacy, and it's our microbes who are, you know, conjuring up the drugs that fill up our pharmacy shelves right there in our colon.
Well, this conjures up what might be a dumb question for either of you, David or Ann, and that is, are the microbes that literally allow plants to feed, are they similar or different to the microbes in our guts that enable our own lives?
Well, one thing about the human microbiome is that many of these microbes live nowhere else except in our gut. So in that sense, they're indigenous to us, and they are not found anywhere else. There's many discoveries yet to be made, however, in the microbiome of the soil and of our bodies. And one of the challenges in this field is that you used to be able to get a microbe and culture it in a lab, and you'd know what it was and what it looked like and what it did. But vast, vast majority of bacteria and many other microbes, you can't culture them outside of their native habitats. So whether that's the soil or the gut, we still don't, I think, quite know if there might be some overlap between maybe a few of the things that are in our bodies and a few of the things that are in our soil. we do know that the functions of these microbes are identical in that in the soil, they're breaking down plant-based organic matter. And the very same thing is happening in our colons. We humans lack many of the enzymes that are needed to break down the complex carbohydrates or what, you know, chemists call polysaccharides in the plant foods. And so, you know, we send them down the hatch. They pass through our stomach, through our small intestine, more or less undigested. Then they hit the colon, and then that's where the breakdown begins. So it's sort of like one big mulch fest down there. I think it would be really interesting to do a comparison of, you know, what do we find in the soil microbiome versus the gut of humans.
You've taught me something I just didn't know, you know, and I should have known by now. I always thought that it was the stomach that broke down food and that's where we got our nutrients, but you're saying no, it happens much lower down.
Well, what's interesting is the stomach's really sort of filled with gastric acids, and so there's dissolving of food starch in the stomach. But the absorption of the nutrients in the food, that doesn't happen until small intestine and colon. And so the foods that we have the enzymes to break down, much of that is absorbed in the small intestine. So that's like your simple carbohydrates. It's broken down, easily absorbed in the small intestine. It's the larger and more complex molecules that pass into the colon, and that's where our microbiota get to work on them. They're actually fermenting them. Another way to maybe think about your colon, I don't know if this is appealing to your listeners or not, but I'll just put it out there. It's, in a way, you know, the whole rage about getting your sauerkraut crock pot out and fermenting cabbage or other vegetables or foods. We've got an onboard fermenter, and that is our colon. So that's where much of the digestion and absorption of other kinds of foods happens, is in the colon.
Well, now, David, you wrote that civilizations can fall when the soil is exhausted or eroded. Is it going too far to start to worry now that our species could be threatened if we similarly endanger microbes in our own bodies, say with antibiotics or with chemicals or any other modern thing, even radiation, for example?
Well, you know, I think that it's probably fair to say that in much the same way that sort of the degradation of the soil on the outside environment can endanger the health of civilizations, that the degradation of the inner soil within us in terms of our microbiota and how it's supported can endanger our own individual health. And it certainly raises questions in terms of, like, if we ever get off this planet and engage in sort of like long-distance space travel, we can't go alone. We're bringing a whole bunch of passengers along with us. We've got to figure out how to care for them. And I think the common element here in my mind is that what it really suggests we need to do is to reorient both agricultural and medical practices around trying to cultivate and feed the beneficial microbes that help sustain the fertility of the soil and help sustain the activity of our immune system and the health of our inner soil, the health of our colons, and all those metabolites that the fiber-fermenting bacteria in our colon actually work for us and produce for us. And that's sort of a different way of thinking about those kinds of practices. You know, we're a remarkably clever and remarkably resilient species. I'm personally not terribly worried about us going extinct over any of these issues. I used to be much more worried about essentially what may happen to civilization in terms of the soil. I actually think there's ways, though, to solve these problems, and they're far simpler than I thought like a decade ago in terms of we can have intensive agriculture capable of feeding the world. We just have to do it differently than we do it today. And if we think about the maintenance of what I call the sort of the inner garden in the inner soil of our colon, you know, if we rethink about the nature of what we eat, the sort of the balance of foods that we eat, and so that we're sure that we provide the fiber fermenters in our colons with an adequate diet, then, you know, we can start, I think, turning around both this sort of epidemic of chronic diseases that have started to affect us, as well as try and turn around the long-term societal epidemic of soil degradation that has plagued not only societies through history, but that is a serious problem in the modern world as well. We just have to think differently about these processes and start to work with and cultivate our microbial allies rather than orienting our practices and our chemical uses around trying to take out the pathogens while inadvertently harming our allies.
Do you folks have a web page, a Facebook spot, or a Twitter feed that listeners should know about to follow up?
Yeah, we sure do. Our website is dig2grow.com. And then that's also our Twitter handle, which is at dig2grow. And then as far as Facebook goes, we're there under the title of the book, The Hidden Half of Nature.
Listeners, I'll put some links to the new book, the older one, and a couple of YouTube videos in my show blog at ecoshock.info. David R. Montgomery is a professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington, and he's the winner of a $500,000 MacArthur Foundation Genius Award back in 2008. His seminal book, still definitely worth a read, is Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations. Now David and co-author biologist Anne Bilke have released a new book just hitting the stores and Amazon. It's called The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. David and Anne, it's been a pleasure having you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, yeah. It's been a real blast. Thank you.
Okay. I'm Alex Smith reporting.